This is the MDT podcast.
A podcast for all healthcare professionals working with older adults. We are a multidisciplinary team educating about aging, MDT.
The MDT is brought to you by the Hearing Aid podcast team. We focus on a different topic each week to work with you to enhance your knowledge to help you look after older people.
Welcome to the MDT podcast. This is episode 4 of series 3, and I am Dr. Ian Wilkinson. I'm a consultant geriatrician at East Surrey Hospital.
And I'm Dr. Jo Preston, and I'm a geriatrician in London.
And this week we're going to be talking about vulnerable adults, adult safeguarding, that whole sort of kit and caboodle that goes with that.
Yes. So joining us in the studio today, we have some of our faculty.
Yeah, hi, my name's Jackie Lelks and I'm a senior lecturer at the University of Brighton, but a social worker by profession.
I'm David Flood. I'm a nurse in safeguarding adults at St George's Healthcare Trust in Tooting.
I'm Tapiwa Moffat and I'm a clinical fellow and I work in East Surrey Hospital.
And today we're going to talk through safeguarding, as we said. But before we do that,
Yes. Things
this week, Jo, what did you spot?
One of the things I saw this week was from Twitter, and it was following one of the palliative care conferences that was going on recently. And at Beck Baines, who's a palliative care registrar, I think, tweeted a link to a list of medications that can't be crushed, which I thought was quite useful. It's called the trade names and then the actual names. It's quite a long list, but I think it's quite useful. So if people have got swallowing difficulties and it's going through an NG tube, or even if you're just modifying it to so they can sort of drink it or whatever, a list of medications that you cannot crush.
That's really useful.
Alternative routes for. So we will tweet that out.
Jackie, got something?
Yeah, it was a book that I have read. It's called The Anatomy of Hope and How People Find Strength in the Face of Illness. And it's written by J.E. Groopman, who's a doctor, actually. But it was just all about how his experiences of being a doctor have led him to believe that hope's really important in relation to how people come through illness, etc. And that it's important that people hold on to that hope whenever they might have a lifelong illness or any other sort of medical condition. So it's just really interesting thinking about that sort of way of looking at illness as well as the traditional way of illness.
That's fab. And I had two things which I'll mention. Well, first thing, we mentioned a couple of episodes ago about the hashtag #EndPJParalysis. Mm. There were some more tweets about that. There was a really great poster with photos of Lego men in pyjamas.
Oh, yeah, I saw that.
Did people see that? That was really, really good. Yeah. I like that. And then also I saw that the Royal College of Surgeons have released some e-learning on duty of candour. Obviously with safeguarding and everything that goes with it, we're talking about today, I thought that sort of semi fits in.
Yeah.
I thought it looks really, really good. Mm. And that you can find that on the Royal College of Surgeons website. So this week we're talking about adult abuse and how to safeguard vulnerable adults. We're going to talk a little bit about the term vulnerable adult and talking about how the signs and symptoms of elder abuse and adult abuse and the legal framework where this all sits and the acts that this sits within.
So anyone that's working with older adults needs to be able to recognise when an adult might be vulnerable. So that's one of our main learning objectives here. And to understand the process of reporting it if you suspect it. And to understand that it's everybody's responsibility to identify people that may be at risk of abuse and that everyone has a responsibility to report it and act on it too, whether it's actual or just suspected. So, as ever, we start with the definition.
And the definition we're going to use for this is from the Action Against Elder Abuse. And the definition that they have for elder abuse is elder abuse is a single or repeated act or lack of appropriate action occurring within any relationship where there is an expectation of trust which causes harm or distress to an older person. I think that's really nice. I think it sort of encapsulates everything, really, that is abuse in an older person, both active and sort of abuse of omission.
Omission, yeah. And I think that's something that when we're taught about child abuse and vulnerable children, that comes up quite a lot, isn't it? It's that neglect of children is a form of abuse. And I think that's something that people don't necessarily think of or flag up as much with older adults. But it's just important. If they're in a vulnerable situation, they're dependent on somebody else for support, then neglect of action is definitely something.
And we'll talk about the different types of abuse a little bit later on, I think. Mm. Older people are particularly vulnerable to abuse, aren't they?
Yes, absolutely. And I think if you look at the worldwide, There's approximately one in 10 older people who experience abuse, but that's each month.
Which
is quite incredible, isn't it? And that comes from the World Health Organization definition. So there's, over 500,000 older people who are abused each year in the UK. And I think there was some recent research that showed that one of the biggest areas of abuse is like financial, but it goes underreported as well. Mm. So that figure is alarmingly high anyway, and that's with an underreporting of it as well, which I think is something that we need to be wary of.
Mm. One of the things we see quite a bit in hospital is that first signs and symptoms that we'll talk about later, and it's very challenging sometimes for staff to understand that people could live in situations that have been described as neglectful, as it seems to go against what we believe in society to care for people. And I think sometimes it's about that perception and understanding of what actual abuse is as a first starting point when we particularly talk about safeguarding with staff.
There's quite a complicated interplay quite often, isn't there, of someone may be at risk of abuse or experiencing some kind of form of control or vulnerability, but is balanced off against if it's a family member that they may be caring for them or don't want to lose their relationship. Mm. So that's kind of a real tension, isn't there?
That sort of ties in with the statistics that show there's an estimate that only one in 24 cases of elder abuse is reported. And older people may be afraid to report cases of abuse because it's family or friends and they're afraid of losing that relationship.
I think older people with dementia are at higher risk, aren't they? And almost two-thirds of people with dementia have been subject to some form of abuse, again, according to the World Health Organization figures. I think that's just astronomical, isn't it? It's really, really high. I think it also highlights the broad definition of what abuse can be, depending on the context.
Mm. Yeah, because physical is what springs to mind, but as we'll talk about later, that's not what the majority of it is. Women who are over the age of 70, particularly if they're dependent or frail or alone, are particularly vulnerable to different forms of abuse.
We'll put an article, we'll put a link to an article that's got some percentages for the different types of abuse into the show notes. And I think it really hits home. Particularly, as you were saying, Jackie, about the financial abuse, doesn't it? How common, potentially, it is.
Yes, and I think that's a good example where older people may not want to take that any further because actually they would rather, be able to see family, et cetera, who may be financially abusing them. So they find that really difficult to take that further. Mm.
And it's not just something with people living on their own. It also occurs in institutions.
Mm. Mm. That's that one area where there really isn't very much data. But there was one survey in the United States that suggested that the rates could be really very high. 36% of staff had witnessed at least one incident of physical abuse of an elderly patient in the previous year. So that suggests the rates are really very high. Mm. And in that same survey, 10% of people surveyed had committed an act of physical abuse themselves towards an elderly patient. And 40% admitted to psychologically abusing patients. So that is really quite shockingly high, I think.
It is.
I think it just stuns you, actually, when you see those sorts of figures, doesn't it, I think?
Yeah.
It's like, because people go into residential care nursing homes and you feel like that they're going to be looked after. And then when you read those sorts of statistics, it's just such a big figure, isn't it? 40% admit that in some way or other they've psychologically abused somebody that they're caring for. And I suppose that's that whole thing you were saying about it goes against human nature in a sense that we see ourselves as being caregivers.
Mm. Mm. I think that's why the training of care home staff is really important. And I think something that's starting to really gather some traction because without adequate training and kind of understanding of these principles that people may not understand or realise they're doing it necessarily.
Absolutely.
I don't think a lot of time it's with malice.
No, I don't think so. And sometimes it's, the physical abuse, it can be just something like how they manual handle somebody. Mm. And from a perspective, that could be seen as abusive, couldn't it? Because of it can lead to injuries. It's not intentional. It's just sometimes for speed, etc.
I think that's the thing, isn't it? It's not always intentional abuse. And when you think about it and you say 40%, you think of, that's a huge figure of intentional abuse. And it's the intentional element of that is probably quite a small percentage.
Yes. Mm. Yeah.
So anyone at all can be at risk of abuse at any age, really. But there are some examples that we're going to talk through now of people who might be at higher risk than others. So someone who's living with frailty, someone who's got a serious health condition or a physical disability.
Those with a visual disability, perhaps a hearing impairment. Those who've got memory problems associated with things like dementia.
Also anyone who's already a victim of domestic violence in the past, and people with mental health difficulties, and also people with learning disabilities.
And I think you can split those risk factors into a number of different categories.
We can. I mean, obviously, individuals are at risk, and at risk from a whole range of situations. So they could be physically frail, or they could have a mental health difficulty that makes them a victim. I think one thing we don't normally talk a lot about with older people is that they could actually have a dependency on alcohol or substances. Mm. And actually, I think that goes, that's something that we tend to ignore, don't we? We see it as a younger person's problem, and we forget that older people could equally be at risk of abusing some form of substance.
Mm. I think certainly in hospital, it is something that, you know, you don't always think about, but it's something you miss at your peril, really, because people get very sick, really very sick when they suddenly don't have their alcohol. And it may not be a lot of alcohol, you know, it may be one or two glasses of alcohol a night, but actually that person is physically dependent on that.
Absolutely.
And when you withdraw that, they...
It's not always night as well. I've certainly met some people dependent, like their tipple by 11.
And living in a shared situation is a risk factor. And it's not really clear whether or not spouses or adult children are more likely to be perpetrators of abuse. But the abuser's dependency on the older person often increases the risk of the abuse. So if the child is financially dependent on the older person, that increases the risk even further.
To take us slightly away from the UK for just a brief second to illustrate that, in South Africa, a few years ago, they introduced a pension to try and address the poverty that people were living in old age when they couldn't obviously work anymore, thinking that that would improve the quality of life of people. And what they found actually was that because there was such a high prevalence of poverty throughout society, actually that put older adults receiving pension at a higher risk of financial and physical abuse from their family, who were also poor, and that actually inadvertently caused a lot more abuse and strain on relationships and put them in a much more vulnerable situation, when actually the objective was to counter that entirely. So it's a really complex relationship there, but something to definitely think of.
I think it also highlights how, as you say, how complex the situation is. So a similar thing sort of in the UK at the moment. Quite rightly, more women are going into the workforce, but equally in large proportions of the society, it's still seen as part of the female role to care for the older relatives.
Yep.
And then that strain there increases the risk a little bit, I think.
Absolutely. I mean, if you think about your own parents, you're not used to washing, dressing, caring for your parents, are you? And then that changes completely, isn't it? You become the parent almost of your parents, and that puts untold strain on people.
And you can see that with dementia and cognitive impairment, especially, because that's a huge strain. Your relationship is completely changing
Absolutely.
With that person, and in a very difficult way that you hadn't foreseen.
Absolutely. And also, you know, you don't foresee things like if somebody becomes violent as a result of that dementia. And I think it's important that we equally remember that it's not necessarily the victim isn't, or the person that's being abused isn't necessarily the individual. It could be the carer as
Absolutely.
Well.
Absolutely.
So another important category of risk factors is community, so social isolation of caregivers and older people. And sometimes the lack of social support that they have can be a risk factor for elder abuse by caregivers. Many elderly people might be isolated because they've lost physical or mental capacity, or because they've lost friends and family members. And I think it's really important to remember to help plug people into sort of support services for carers, especially recognise the stress they're under early, so that you can help to prevent that sort of isolation and strain.
Carer support is something we can all do.
Absolutely.
And signpost people to the give the support yourself, but also signpost people to the relevant support agencies.
And it's important to remember that carers are entitled to their own assessment as well under the Care Act, to think about what their needs might be. So if you can try to address some of those give them some support, that can really change the dynamics of a relationship.
Another risk factor is sociocultural. The factors that may affect the risk of elder abuse include depiction of older people as frail, weak and dependent, erosion of the bonds between generations of a family. Systems of inheritance, so things around families, land rights and things around housing. One of the things that we often see in hospital is unfortunately, disagreements over inheritance and things like that, and people's belief that they have a right to their parents' house, and that's been used as collateral for paying for care, etc. Young people moving away and leaving generations by themselves, and in general, the lack of funds to pay for care can all have an impact, and an impact on the risk.
And I think that's something as a society we're still sort of coming to terms with, isn't it? That there's been such a seismic shift in that over the last 50 years. And I think we're still feeling our way as to how, as a society, we're going to cope with those pressures going forwards.
Yeah, I don't think we've got any easy answers at the moment.
No.
But it's something I think we see quite a lot of in hospital, the impacts of that, and particularly on the strain in the relationships.
Mm. And kind of moving on then to in institutions, we talked briefly before about abuse may occur there. It may be that that is because the standards for healthcare and the welfare services available and care facilities for that older person are low in that environment, and that the staff has been poorly trained or aren't paid very much or working very hard and overworked and doing the best that they can in quite a strained circumstance. Whether the physical environment is deficient and makes it harder to provide high quality care. And where policies of the institution operate in the interests of the institution rather than the residents and the people that are there. And all of these things have come directly from a World Health Organization fact sheet that we'll put a link to in the show notes. So we've been a bit doom and gloom about the situation there. What we're going to do next is we're going to talk about safeguarding and what that means. You may have heard the term and not be quite sure what it is. So Jackie and David are going to talk a little bit now about what safeguarding is, how you might raise that.
Yeah, I think the important thing to think about is that there isn't an eligibility criteria to safeguard somebody. It's for, you know, anybody that you believe to be at risk of being abused can be referred and can be looked at to see how we safeguard. There are some criteria that the local authority will look at, who are the people that have responsibility for an investigation, which we're not going to talk about today, but obviously they're the people that would have the overall lead in relation to that. So it's important that the person would have care and support needs. It doesn't matter whether the local authority is meeting those needs or paying for that need. So that includes self-funders in there, so people who are paying for their own care. As well, equally, we need to safeguard and protect those people.
And could those needs be met by family members as well?
Yeah, family members, anybody who's got some sort of care or support needs, really. That's the crucial part, really, that they have. Because otherwise, there's a sense that, in a sense, they may be able to protect themselves if they're not vulnerable in the sense that they need care and support needs. Obviously, that they're experiencing, or not just experiencing abuse, even if you have concerns that they may be at risk of being abused, it's important to have that discussion and talk that through. Because those two things together, really, it's about that the person doesn't have the ability to protect themselves, and therefore they need somebody to come in and support them with that and to think a way through that. I think it's important that there's something called making safeguarding personal. And I think it's important that we think about that, because that's really about that in terms of what happens if you were to make an alert in the sense of saying that there's some concerns, then it's very much driven by what that individual wants. And it's very much driven about them being part of that process of looking into what's going on with them and what do they want to happen? What outcomes do they want to achieve? I think there's this image that in the past that maybe that was the person was lost in that process of trying to safeguard them, and that making safeguarding personal is really about putting the person back in the middle of that.
Is that a book?
No, it's a government leaflet, and you can download it and get it online. In fact, we can put the link
we'll
up.
Yeah.
And that links nicely with some of the principles that the Care Act has enshrined in law around empowerment and prevention. Proportionality, protection, partnership and accountability are all long words. But in essence, it's about working with the individual, as Jackie says, working to try and get their voice across about what they want, being proportionate in our responses Safeguarding can often be seen to be quite overreactive, often risk averse. It's working with those principles that actually the person knows best. They can make their own judgments, often with support around the risk factors, taking into account things like relationships, and working in partnership with all the agencies that are involved. Often it's very difficult to work with just one or two agencies. When agencies work together with the person, often get better accountability and outcomes.
And I think you raise a really important point that's worth emphasising there, which is that you don't have to have evidence of the abuse. No. Just a suspicion is enough. Yeah. Because this isn't raising this big, heavy-handed thing. It's proportional and it's involving the person. It's literally giving them a framework to be supportive.
And you're raising the question for it to be investigated by the local authority.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's just that you have a concern, isn't it? And I think the difficulty is that if you don't raise those concerns, that's when things can deteriorate. And it could be that through that open, transparent process of talking to the individual, that with support, it can change that situation quite dramatically for somebody. Mm.
So next we're going to talk about what to do if you suspect abuse, but we're going to recap the different types of abuse that you might see.
The CARE Act 2014 identifies 10 categories of abuse, but that list isn't exhaustive. It's also important to remember that an individual can be subject to more than one type of abuse at any one time. So the list they give is physical abuse, domestic violence or abuse, sexual abuse, psychological or emotional abuse, financial or material abuse, modern slavery, discriminatory abuse, organisational or institutional abuse, neglect or acts of omission, and self-neglect.
And I think if you have evidence of or suspect any of those things, they are sort of your overt triggers into raising some kind of safeguarding alert or safeguarding investigation. And I think probably if we now go through about, well, what do you do when you see something and you suspect something? How should you manage that?
Most organisations have policies and procedures in place, but whoever takes the lead, one of the most important things to do where possible is talk to the person first. Find out, ask a few questions, try not to be too overreactive or judgmental and use open questioning to find out a little bit about what's going on and whether they share those concerns. And from there, ask about what they would like to happen. And normally there would be somebody senior within the organisation, such as a hospital, where you can get advice from, or you can speak to social services about taking that forward. There are cases when it's very difficult sometimes where the person doesn't agree. And on those situations, we would advise that you seek advice from senior people about taking that forward, because those are sometimes very difficult situations.
I think there's a couple of really important things as well. You need to stay really calm when you're having that discussion, because you could be hearing some really difficult messages because some abuse can be horrendous, and therefore you have to somehow have your poker face on in a sense and not react in such a way, because otherwise that person's likely to stop talking and that you could lose lots of information in there. I think the other really important point is don't promise people that you're not going to report it, because it may be that you do need to go and talk to somebody and you do need to explain what's happened to somebody. And I think if we make those promises to people that we're not going to raise those concerns with other people, we've lost trust, haven't we, really, at that very start point for trying to work with somebody who, as we said, you know, the abuse is at all sorts of levels. That it can be quite horrendous in terms of some of the abuse that people suffer. And what we don't want to do is lose their trust as they've disclosed straight away. From my experiences when I was in practice, that sometimes when people are in their own homes, they find it quite difficult to disclose, because the person who may be hurting them is around and near. It could be family members, etc. But when they come into hospital, it feels like a really safe environment, or they go into other places, you know, into a rest home maybe or somewhere like that. It's a really safe environment. So that's when they start to potentially give information. And I think that's the bit, if we lose that trust, we're sort of lost them, haven't we, as a person, really.
And there might only be that one opportunity.
Yes,
I think some of the serious case reviews have shown that if health and social care professionals had acted upon their concerns and got more information at that point, then the death or the serious harm that then went on and occurred may well have been prevented.
Absolutely. I think, and that's a really important point about just sharing those concerns, isn't it? And listening and sharing any concerns. And it may be that you share it with somebody senior to yourself, or a lead in terms of safeguarding, and that's all you need to do, because they'll then take the responsibility for where it goes after that.
And I think, just leading on from that also, there's some of the types of abuse that you may come into contact with not only are sort of acts of abuse, they're also crimes.
Yes.
And in those situations, then you have the police also as people that you can go to and help support any investigation. Yeah. And action that needs to take place.
I think that's an important point, isn't it, in the terms of, you know, listening more than questioning the person. Because if it is a crime, the police are trained to have those discussions with people so that the evidence is collected, so that it then could potentially go, if the person wished it to, it could go to court potentially.
Which I think moves us nicely into the kind of legal mandate, which we're just going to touch on briefly now, a bit about the Care Act and the Human Rights Act.
So the Care Act came in 2014, came in December 2015. It really radically changed the way that the legal mandate that we have for working with adults, so 18 upwards. And it brought together, and actually for the first time made safeguarding what we call statutory, so there's a legal requirement to investigate if the person wishes, and that's the important part as of going back to making safeguarding personal. It's about what does the person want to happen in the situation. But it clearly states in the Care Act the importance of protecting people from abuse or neglect, amongst a lot of other things, but that's one of the things that it does, and it looks at how we undertake a safeguarding inquiry as well. So as the local authority becomes the lead agency in relation to doing a safeguarding inquiry, that doesn't mean that they can't ask other agencies to be part of that process and to support with that process and actually even to do the investigation. So, for example, I'm a social worker. I'm not really trained to look at things like pressure sores or pressure areas, for example. I don't have that level of understanding. That's where I really need a nurse or someone to be involved to give me that level of understanding of what's happened in this situation. Mm. Whereas I'm much more able in terms of care, et cetera, and things like that. But, you know, physical abuse, we need all of that evidence to be collected together. And it's interesting that that includes housing for the first time as well. And they have a mandate as well to be involved in there. And to, how do we include housing? And because people lived in sheltered housing accommodation, et cetera, or local authorities. So how do we include housing? But also, I think, as I mentioned earlier as well, there's also a duty to safeguard the carers under the Care Act, and they're entitled to their own assessment, and they're entitled to support, as long as they meet the criteria, they're entitled to support that will alleviate, hopefully, some of the stress that's on them, and that can really reduce the risk of abuse that somebody might be upon. I think another really important thing that the Care Act has brought in is the importance of advocates for people who are, the term's unbefriended, but there is nobody around. They have no family or friends. That links to your point about people having emigrated and moved away, etc. And so therefore they could appoint an advocate who's there to support them through the process and just to make sure that they understand what's happening, so that they're supported through that inquiry as well, and they'll work with them. A lot of what I've just talked about is for people with capacity, and I suppose there's always the element where people have lost capacity, and therefore there are different criteria around for somebody who has lost capacity, just because decisions may need to be made on their behalf.
And kind of briefly highlighting what those are, so you can go away and have a look at them. I think we've talked about them in some of the other episodes, things like IMCAs, Independent Mental Capacity Advocates. There is also a power of attorney. So if you have given power of attorney to someone else and before you lose capacity, then they can make decisions on your behalf as though they are you. If someone hasn't assigned a power of attorney, then that happens, that layer of protection happens through the Court of Protection. You would have to apply to the Court of Protection for decisions to be made.
Yeah, I think it's just important just to note with the power of attorney, it's for health and welfare and not finances, because there's some confusion over those two.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the other piece of legislation surrounding this is the Human Rights Act.
The Human Rights Act 1998 effectively enshrined the European Convention on Human Rights into our own law. So that's really important because it means that local authorities and courts, because they're public bodies, they have a duty to consider those human rights when they make a decision about an individual. And wherever any rights are conflicting, they need to strike a balance and make sure that they act proportionately to what they're trying to protect. Examples of some of those rights, Article 3, the right not to be subject to torture, inhuman or degrading treatment. That's relevant here because treatment can be degrading if it humiliates or debases an individual. So many aspects of abuse would trigger that, right?
Mm-hmm. Great. And I think that that kind of pulls together a lot of what we wanted to say about elder abuse and adult safeguarding. And it's a huge area, and it's probably something we're going to revisit in a number of different guises or from different angles in the future.
Mm. I think we just finish up with a nice summary from Lord Justice Munby, who said, "What good is it to make someone safer if it merely makes them miserable?" Just going back to that, this is about the person. What are we doing to help them to live a full and independent life as much as they can safely?
If you've got any comments on that episode or any really good resources you want other people to know about or you want to share, then please do get in touch with us. We can be found on Twitter at MDT_podcast.
At our website, www.thehearingaidpodcasts.org.uk, where you can email us in the top right-hand corner.
You can also find us on Facebook and on Twitter.
The MDT Podcast.
So now it's time for our catchy quiz. This is the MD teaser.
Yes.
So this is a bit like the game that you've all played, Articulate, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. So
other games
I have
are available.
A word in front of me here that I'm going to try and get Joe to guess, and a series of words that I'm not allowed to use.
And I'm co-opting Jackie onto my team this time. Tappy and David, do you keep time?
Yeah.
For us, 30 seconds.
Ready, Joe?
Absolutely.
So, this is an item that is found in a number of care facilities. It is helpful
chair.
When... It's very similar to a chair.
A hoist.
No, I'm not allowed to use the word chair. it's, but you said it. Okay, so it's similar to one of those things, and it's useful when someone wants to have
commode.
A wee.
Yay!
Yeah. Yeah.
How many seconds was that?
It was 20 seconds.
20 seconds. Ooh, a long one. Ooh. Okay. Jackie, so, do you want to... So, should we get... David, do you want to guess Jackie's? Should we
okay.
do it that way?
Yeah.
I'll try.
All right. Are you ready?
Go.
So, this is something that you may give to somebody when they're confused. It's to give, bring them comfort, really, and it's something that they can play with. And it's texturised and...
Some kind of... it's like a stress ball or something like that. Like a.
It's made of material.
Like a little comfort blanket.
Mm-hmm. But they're confused, so they've got some form of.
Dementia that may.
It's a dementia blanket.
Dementia blanket.
So you said both words just in.
But not in the wrong way.
So how many seconds was that?
Oh, that was.
It was about.
That was 41 seconds.
Oh, like, I'm out of time.
Loads of time.
Yeah.
So if you've been guessing the MD teaser for the last few episodes, we're now going to give you the answer. And Joe, the answer is the sound was...
It was a drug round.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So if you go to the website, you'll see who won that episode
mm-hmm.
or who won the coveted MDT mug.
MDT mug, yeah.
And that'll be winging their way to that person very shortly.
Yeah.
And now we have a new sound.
Yep.
And this is the first bit of that sound. What do you think it is?
Let us know on Twitter at MDT_podcast.
Using the hashtag MDTeaser.
Or through facebook.com/MDTpodcast.
And I think you can put the hashtag MDTeaser there as well.
You can, indeed.
Or you can contact us through the website, which is www.thehearingaidpodcasts.org.uk. And we'll give you the answer to this MDTeaser in 2 episodes' time. So that'll be in episode 6.
MDT will reconvene in 2 weeks' time.
Dr. Wilkinson has previously received funding from Astellas and UCB Pharmaceuticals for delivering educational activities. The MDT podcast is a hearing aid podcast's Big Things Media production. Additional music by Kevin MacLeod. This podcast has been made possible from a technology-enhanced learning grant from Health Education England, spreading education throughout Kent, Surrey and Sussex. For more information, visit thehearingaidpodcasts.org.uk.